Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the February-March issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Editor's note. The Power of the Picture by Dana Joseph. You should see the photographic wonderland that our offices in Dallas become when we're voting on CNI's annual Visions of the West photo contest. Our color printer gets crazy hot from the continuous demand as the walls fill with image after image of the people and places, flora and fauna, that readers have captured, transforming our space into a veritable gallery. That's the overall effect, a wondrous, wide-ranging walk through the West. But get up close for an isolated view of just one image, and you're transported into a singular story, a unique moment. That was certainly the hot pink experience of gazing at Cloud Coppice's winning photograph, Powerful Connections, of Ojibwe artist-dancer Michelle Reed. Michelle is from northern Michigan, but she spends a lot of time in South Dakota, says Coppice, who is from the Mount Rushmore state. The two originally met when Reed was in South Dakota dancing with the indigenous music group Brulé. This particular photo came about when Michelle was an artist in residence teaching sewing and beading at the Cheyenne River Youth Project in Eagle Butte, South Dakota, Coppice says. The youth project sponsors an event each year called Red Can Graffiti Jam, where artists paint murals throughout the town. We wandered around town taking photos of her in front of various murals. The mural in the image is by graffiti artist Dueno Insano Manuel. The woman the mural depicts is Redbird, wife of Chief, shot in the eye, and one of the most recognized Lakota women warriors who fought at Little Bighorn. The colors of the mural just happened to match the regalia Michelle was wearing that day. For her part, Reed says, the picture represents the jingle dress, the healing dress, and the sweet grass. The medicine we carry is a part of that. Healing and sharing this medicine through Chad's photographs, while also sharing the beauty of the places he travels to and brings recognition to, is why I feel this photo has so much life and is so powerful. Coppice, who has retired from a photography career with South Dakota Tourism, is the co-founder of the Black Hills Photo Shootout, an annual fall photography workshop in South Dakota's Black Hills. He also now covers his home state for South Dakota Magazine from his base in Pierre. If you leave it up to me to choose what to shoot, it's going to be Western. Cowboys and Indians, if you will, he says. I love shooting rodeo, cowboys on ranches, powwows, and Native Americans in any kind of situation. Variety is the key to photography in South Dakota, whether we're talking about landscapes, weather, wildlife, or people. From the very western landscapes of the Badlands and Black Hills to farm country and the urban feel of the eastern side of the state, there's never a lack of things to photograph. That goes for all the varied West. There's no end to the photogenic potential out there. We hope that perusing these photo-filled pages will inspire you to pick up your camera and start shooting. The Cowboys at 50. A look back at the stirring John Wayne classic with new insights from Duke's youngest son, Ethan, by Joe Layden. 50 years ago, when the Cowboys opened at theaters and drive-ins everywhere, many moviegoers responded with startled gasps or angry howls of protest when John Wayne's heroic Will Anderson was shot in the back by Bruce Dern's despicable Asa Watts. But Ethan Wayne, the Duke's young son, took it all in stride. Although he was not quite yet 10 years old at the time, Ethan already was enough of a Hollywood professional not to get too rattled on by on-screen mayhem, even when his dad was on the receiving end of the gunfire. "I grew up seeing that sort of thing on movie sets," Ethan recalled during a recent chat with CNI, "so it didn't affect me, but it did affect Marissa, my younger sister. She was traumatized by watching the film. No kidding." "We were watching it at my father's house," Ethan said. "They did a screening there for friends and family. There was like a big couch in the back and a smaller couch in the front where the kids were. And man, when he died, she just let out this noise of despair. Even though her dad was right there in the room, it was still so traumatic for her. But it wasn't for me. I figured, it's only a movie. They're playing pretend." For the benefit of those tuned in late, The Cowboys, directed by Mark Rydell, the Reavers on Golden Pond, and adapted by scripters Irving Ravecht, Harriet Frank Jr., and William Dale Jennings from Jennings' novel, is a gritty coming-of-age story that many John Wayne fans, including Ethan, rank among the Duke's very best films. The pitch? When cattle rancher Will Anderson finds his ranch hands have galloped off to the gold fields, he hires some school-age greenhorns, including newbies played by Robert Carradine, A. Martinez, and future world champion team roper Clay O'Brien Cooper, to drive his herd to market. But when Anderson is killed by a vicious rustler, the boys must become gunmen to avenge his death. Ethan was to spend quality time with his father while on location in New Mexico, sharing a house with the Duke, who turned 64 during the production, and Los Angeles Times writer Wayne Warga, who was working on a never-completed Wayne biography. And even though Bruce Dern was unforgettably fearsome on screen, I remember liking him in person. I was impressed with him because he was really athletic. He would run to the set. He was staying at a place 6 or 8 miles away, so he'd show up kind of sweaty and then put his stuff on. And I thought, man, that dude's cool. And he was a nice person to be around when I was a little boy. On the other hand, when I saw the final film, I was taken aback by how bad he could be, and how you found yourself just hating him. Like I said, I was old enough to know that it was all just make-believe, and what he did was all part of the story. But he had all the character traits that you don't want in yourself. You just hope you're never that guy when things get difficult. Dern did a good job. When asked about his own favorites among his father's films, Ethan names some of the classics: The Quiet Man, The Searchers, True Grit, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and admits that while he never looked at Big Jake as one of his better films, it's a sentimental favorite because he was cast as the Duke's kidnapped grandson in the 1971 Western. Still, he's much fonder of The Cowboys, which he views as having been the right movie at the right time for both of them. "I wasn't an adult," Ethan said, "but I was old enough to be aware of things that were happening, interactions between people, spending time with my dad. We could go on horseback rides together. He'd let me drive the car to the location, and he'd be yelling at me the whole time he'd let me drive. I got to hang out with him a lot, and now looking back, That character that he plays in the Cowboys really reminds me of my father. Ethan currently devotes most of his time to John Wayne Enterprises, which manages the name, image, and likeness of his father, and the John Wayne Cancer Foundation. And when it comes to hiring new employees, there's one movie above all others that he encourages applicants to study. "I'll also tell them some other ones to watch," Ethan said, "but start with The Cowboys, because I think The Cowboys really represents what I'm trying to do with the John Wayne brand now. I feel like my father was an honest character in that movie, and he was really honest with those boys and was a great leader for them and a great example. And he tried to give them a foundation to build a life on and their manhood on, being tough but fair, tough but with compassion, tough for the good of the other person, not for the detriment of the other person. He was being tough to help them face life. And that's one of the main reasons I think it's a wonderful movie." Don Jones. After the Civil War, the country's north-south orientation gave way to a new focus, Western migration. Explorers, miners, and settlers went west in waves, some of them carrying cameras with the idea of documenting the frontier, from landscapes to mining claims. Among the earliest of these photographers of the American West were Timothy H. O'Sullivan and Carlton Watkins, both of whom had to struggle with the wet plate negative process and the bulky equipment that went with it. The process was not only unwieldy and difficult to control, but the use of poisonous chemicals made it dangerous. Well, more than a century later, Colorado-based photographer Don Jones resurrects the archaic process to create stunning contemporary imagery with a striking vintage character. A graduate of Brooks Institute of Photography in Santa Barbara, California, Jones assisted award-winning Vanity Fair photographer Annie Leibovitz in 1995 and 1996 while she was shooting athletes training for the games in Atlanta for the book Olympic Portraits. After working on high-profile projects using state-of-the-art equipment, Jones found himself drawn to the earliest days of photography. Now immersed in the highly specialized 19th century wet plate photographic process, Jones uses an 8x10 Dierdorf view camera and special lenses made in the late 1800s. Creating the wet plate portraits requires that the photographic material be coated, sensitized, exposed, and developed within the span of about 15 minutes. His mobile rig allows him to travel to his subjects, who have included cowboys, cowgirls, and great-grandson of Chief Sitting Bull, Ernie LaPointe, and capture them in authentic environments. Don Jones' work will be on view March 10th through April 10th at Broadmoor Galleries in the Broadmoor Resort in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Visit him online at donjonesphotography.com. Priscilla Ticini. In one of Navajo photographer Priscilla Ticini's award-winning images, a coyote with a deer skin at his feet is superimposed onto a background of a mountain range and a starry sky. In another, a woman stands on the edge of a cliff with the tail of a swirl of corn pollen at her fingertips. Graphic and sharp, the images are strong and finely orchestrated, and they are full of meaning. As a Navajo, it's important for me to share my traditional stories and to keep that going for my people in my culture and for the younger people in my tribe, says Ticini, who lives in Prescott Valley, Arizona. We have traditional storytellers that are telling stories and making illustrations in books and trying to keep our stories alive for the generation behind us, and I'm using photography to do that as well. After working as a graphic designer for the Prescott Daily Courier, and then for 14 years as a fine art photographer, primarily focusing on landscapes, then portraiture, and sometimes blending the two, Ticini made the decision to take her photography in a different direction, toward something more conceptual. I started doing more storytelling, putting composite photos together to tell a story inspired by Navajo traditional stories, and create something beautiful, like an art piece, says Ticini, who shoots with a Nikon D750. My style is more like a painter. R.C. Gorman, a well-known Navajo painter who painted women in a simplistic way, is one of my influences. I want to show the beauty of my people. Each element of her photographs is intentional, a symbolic representation of something more. The one with the coyote, the hide, the mountains, and the stars is a photographic illustration of a Navajo creation story. The Milky Way is the result of the coyote's impatience with the earth's creators, the holy people, who were carefully placing the stars in the sky one by one. But the coyote, he's off in the distance and he's watching, and on the fourth day he became impatient, and he decided that it was taking too long. So he picked up the hide in his mouth and threw it up the stones, and that's how we got the Milky Way, she says. One photo is layered on top of another and manipulated so it appears as one. It often takes up to 40 hours from start to finish as Ticini blends the colors together, much like a painter would do. In the corn pollen piece, the photograph of a woman wearing a red and white blanket standing on a cliff's edge was taken on the Navajo reservation where she grew up and where she takes many of her landscape photos. I had some photos of clouds and I added in the corn pollen, and with Photoshop, I made the cloud go in a swirl. I've evolved into a photographer who does graphic art. I spend hours trying to work with these images to look like I shot it that way. My graphic design background and knowing Photoshop and years of training really helped me blend my images to where they look seamless and authentic. Still, not everyone gets it, at least not at first. Once someone says, "Can you tell me what this is?" And when I explain to them what it means, it's instantly, "Oh my gosh, I have to have that piece." Once they understand what it means, it gets sold. Through the lens of Navajo photographer Priscilla Ticini will be on view through March 31st at Amerind Museum in Dragoon, Arizona. See her work on her website, squashblossomphotos.com. Jim Trosper. Conveying the night skies of his ancestors inspires Chickasaw photographer Jim Trosper. You might say he's literally shooting for the stars. After hiking a few miles into Oklahoma's Wichita Mountains, usually sometime between 2 and 3 a.m., when the Milky Way begins to streak across the black sky, Trosper clicks the shutter on his Canon 5D Mark III camera, steadied on a tripod. He shoots a long exposure, 30 seconds, in order to capture the sharpness and brilliance of the nighttime sky. That's long enough for the stars to sink in and not enough to start moving across the sky, he says. The stars really pop on a really dark sky. What began as a senior project for a bachelor's degree in photographic arts at the University of Central Oklahoma ignited a passion for the stars that he didn't realize he had. I had no idea how to do it, but I wanted to challenge myself and separate myself from the pack. So I put some time into it to figure out the technical aspect of it. Crunching the numbers and getting to know how the camera works, you have to play with light to allow the right amount into your camera in order to do starscapes. I didn't know if I would produce something I would even like, but once it started to come together, it sparked a passion for photography that just took off. Trosper, now 29, has been shooting astral photography in his native Oklahoma for the past 8 years and winning awards, showing in Chickasaw art shows and Oklahoma City art galleries. I'm Chickasaw, and seeing the same sky as my ancestors, who were one with the land, and conveying the importance of the night sky is part of why I do this. Because the nighttime sky has a predetermined path, knowing exactly where to be to find the stars at their brightest takes careful planning and a lot of patience. Instead of being in front of something and capturing the image, I almost have a picture in my head before I take it, says Trosper, whose photographs usually include something rooted into the earth, like a craggy tree or snow-capped peaks, to add drama, perspective, and scale. I hike in the Wichita Mountains regularly, and I know spots I want to shoot. Then I'll hike in around 8 p.m., and I'll just set up where I want to be and get to know the night. He waits until the stars line up like he imagined them in his mind, then starts shooting. He stays until daybreak when the sky begins to show light. It's one of those things that never get old, he says of his all-nighters. It's like an ancestral trait. We're all seeing the same things that our ancestors saw. It's something that all humans connect to on a primal level, which is what he hopes to convey in his work, that symbiotic relationship between us all and what's around us. Trosper even reproduces his images on high-gloss aluminum so viewers can see themselves in the photograph instead of regarding it as an object to be admired. I'm just trying to get people to put themselves in a moment to appreciate nature and landscapes for what they are, to feel the stillness and transport themselves into the scene. Visit Jim Trosper at the Artesian Arts Festival in Sulphur, Oklahoma, May 26th through 29th, and online at jimtrosper.com. Form, function, and fun. The co-owner of Texas's Three Springs Ranch designed its interiors to reflect the surrounding great outdoors and to provide comfort and luxury for lucky guests. By Hunter Hawk. In the unincorporated central Texas community of Zephyr lies a 1,240-acre ranch and resort designed for both luxury and adventure. Dodie Mills, co-owner of Three Springs Ranch, has made it her mission for the last 5 years to create and maintain a world-class destination for gatherings, hunting trips, weddings, girls' getaways, and more. And it's in a prime location, centrally located among Dallas, Austin, Waco, and San Antonio. The ranch has recently gone on the market. Potential buyers would certainly be intrigued by the commercial travel potential, an Olympic-sized skeet range, a resort pool, a lake, 5 ponds, cell towers, a 10,000-square-foot event pavilion, and so on, not to mention 6 houses on the property totaling 16 bedrooms. Design lovers, though, might focus more on what Mills has done, or not done, with the spaces and rooms throughout. Linda Plant of Sotheby's International Realty, says that Mills' design restraint and devotion to the natural surroundings impressed her greatly when she took on the listing. "It's all in the materials and in the way everything opens up to the scenery. That's your decoration, basically," Plant says. "It's a notch above as far as design goes. There's certainly nothing lacking in luxury and comfort for the hunters and visitors, but you could also host a high-end event. The Mills have built something that stands the test of time." Read on for more from Dodi Mills on how she designed the interiors of Three Springs Owner's Residence and Guest Lodge. Bringing the Outside In. Mills set out to balance interior colors and textures in the natural beauty of Three Springs Outdoor Oasis. She didn't see the need for too much distracting decor. The owner's residence sets the standard for every other part of the ranch in that respect. Features in the kitchen and main sitting area were selected to bring brilliant natural hues inside. "The colors here are unlike any colors you've ever seen," Mills says. "Even throughout the winter, the greens are just everywhere. So the green island, it had to happen. It's kind of the anchor for the whole side of the house. And then, without fail, the sunsets here are very pinkish. So I told my contractor, we have to have pink granite. It took 3 years of hunting and searching, but we found it." Colorful chairs in the sitting area also reflect shades of nature. And Mills has created additional focal points elsewhere in different rooms with art and glassware, including a piece in the kitchen inspired by a sable antelope Mills often spots in the wide open spaces on the ranch. Design as a through line. Mills wanted certain signature textures and materials to tie the owner's residence together with the guest houses and other buildings on the property. Every single ceiling in every building, whether it's in a pavilion, an outcropping, inside every house, has the same ceiling of rusted old barn tin. No matter how modern or how old, there had to be a common denominator. She took a similar approach with exterior features. When we originally bought this ranch 5 years ago, there was a big old lodge up here. It already had all of the stone, which is from a local quarry. It already had the pillars established. I wanted to carry that throughout, whether it was columns or entire little buildings. A lodge fit for living. In a ranch custom made for big group hunting trips, the lodge space is as important as the main residence, and Mills spared no expense to make Three Circles Lodge as comfortable as humanly possible. That meant plenty of cushy seating, open spaces for gathering, and yes, views of the land everywhere you look. The lodge is for the guys. They go out for their hunt. They come in, and they want to just get in a big chair and sit and talk about their hunt, says Mills, noting that the taxidermy on the walls all came from hunts in the area. If it's a Saturday, they're all into their football, she says. And in winter, further along in the season, there's a big fire going. She also made sure there were fun interactive elements, such as the shuffleboard table made from barn wood. And when it's time for a large group dinner, the lodge's simple but elegant dining room is the go-to space. There's actually two tables, just end-to-end, and they're super heavy. They're solid, handmade mesquite, and they're amazing. It took a stroke of luck to find equally amazing matching chairs. They were tearing down a hotel in New York City, and they put all of these chairs on eBay. I got 22 of them, just what I needed. They had to be ancient because they're worn, but I didn't want to redo them. make them pretty, clean, or new. I wanted them to be old like they look. The entire ranch and its minimalist take on comfort are a wonder to behold thanks to Mill's design work. And here's the kicker. She's not a designer by trade, just a do-it-yourselfer with exquisite taste and an interest in human experiences. I just put my heart into things that would please people, whether it's a lodging, a home, a barn, a pool, a house. What would make them feel like they had just been on the greatest vacation without even leaving the state of Texas? You'd think after achieving her vision, Mills would want to stay a while. But for her, the joy was obviously in the journey. Asked if she feels trepidation putting three springs on the market, she's quick to say no. Why? Because she wants another design challenge in her next home. I'm going to do it again. Find out more about Three Springs Ranch at threespringsranch.com.
Hello, this is Michael, reading from the archives of True West Magazine, April 1961 edition. True West exclusive. Here, appearing for the first time in print, are the memoirs of Roswell attorney James Madison Hervey, a friend of Pat Garrett's. Hervey refused to allow his views about the killing of Garrett to be released until 8 years after his death. Read his candid opinion of the slaying of the famous New Mexico sheriff. The Assassination of Pat Garrett by James Madison Hervey. Editor's note. No one knew more about the assassination of Pat Garrett, Lincoln County, New Mexico sheriff, than the late James Madison Hervey, Roswell attorney, who, just before he died in 1953, was induced to put on paper all the information he had with the understanding it would not be published until 8 years after his death, at which time no one connected with it would likely be living. His account has just been released by members of his family to this magazine for publication and reveals many facets of the case of which little heretofore has been known. I have been asked to give an account of what I learned about the death of Pat Garrett, famous Lincoln County sheriff, by my actual contact with evidence at that time, by what I found from personal investigation shortly thereafter, and what I know about conditions previous to his death. To clarify this matter, it is necessary to briefly review Garrett's life. He was a buffalo hunter in the locality of Fort Griffin in western Texas in the 70s and knew my father, who was a trader and dealer in buffalo hides and hunter's supplies. He came over into New Mexico in the late 70s and was in the mercantile business at Fort Sumner. It was here that he met Billy the Kid and became acquainted with him. As has been related in histories, Garrett was afterwards elected sheriff of Lincoln County. Billy the Kid was tried at Las Cruces, New Mexico in the spring of 1881 for the murder of Brady, sheriff of Lincoln County, and was sentenced to be hanged in Lincoln. The jail in Lincoln being unsafe, he was kept in the courtroom and guarded day and night. He succeeded in getting advantage of the guards. He killed them both, escaped, and practically dropped off the face of the earth for several months. Garrett was not in Lincoln on the day this happened, but thereafter, he constantly worked undercover to locate the hiding place of the Kid. It was not very long because he got information in July that the Kid was hiding around Fort Sumner. Garrett took two deputies, John W. Poe and Kip McKinney, and they set out on horseback for Fort Sumner, which was an abandoned military post, but still a settlement and a trading point. Garrett and his two deputies hid in the neighborhood of Fort Sumner until night, and then cautiously proceeded to the house of Pete Maxwell, where Garrett found Billy and killed him. When I was a boy, 10 or 11 years old, I lived for a few months with Mr. and Mrs. Poe on their farm near Roswell, and this is the story given by Mr. Poe as well as I can remember it. When Garrett's term of office as sheriff expired, he came to Roswell and purchased a farm, as did John W. Poe. At that time, what is now Chavez County was a part of Lincoln County. A good many years later, in 1889, Chavez County was created. Garrett wanted to be the first sheriff of Chavez County. In the meantime, Garrett and Poe became unfriendly, and Poe did not care to have Garrett sheriff. I remember the campaign very well. They were both busy working on the election, one for and the other against. There was only one party, which was the Democratic Party, but this was a division in the party. As a result of the election, Garrett was defeated, very much to his chagrin and disappointment. He felt, in fact, that on the record he had made as sheriff of Lincoln County, the people should have elected him as the first sheriff of Chavez County. About this time, James J. Hagerman, Colorado millionaire and owner of the famous Molly Gibson Mine, decided to build a railroad from Pecos, Texas, north through New Mexico to Amarillo, and had his representatives in the neighborhood of Roswell buying up the farms. Garrett took advantage of the opportunity to sell out and move to Uvalde, Texas. Sometime after this, in the spring of 1896, there occurred what is known now as the Fountain Murder, presumably somewhere in the White Sands of New Mexico between Alamogordo and Las Cruces. Fountain was a prominent Republican in Donna Ana County, of which Las Cruces is the county seat, and had been member of the legislature. He was an attorney and a criminal prosecutor of considerable force and vigor. In 1895 and 1896, he was employed by an association of cattle owners to prosecute persons charged with theft of cattle. At the approaching term of Lincoln County Court in 1896, he was to go to Lincoln and prosecute a number of persons so charged. He set out in a buckboard and took his small son, about 4 years old, with him for company. The work of prosecuting was done, and he set out for home, but has never been heard of to date. His disappearance created a great deal of excitement, and his friends spent large sums of money and much time endeavoring to apprehend his murderers, as it was assumed, beyond any question, that he was murdered as a result of his prosecution of cattle thieves. Someone conceived the idea of bringing Garrett up from Uvalde and setting him to work as a detective on the job. This was done, and after working for a number of months, he was elected sheriff of Donna Ana County, and thereupon, he moved to Las Cruces. Practically all of Garrett's time and thought was devoted to apprehending the murderers of Colonel Fountain. He had various clues, and at one time took a posse and arrested a man upon whom his suspicion centered. But apparently he was wrong, as the man was tried and acquitted, and thereafter Garrett continued his search. This he did long after his term as sheriff had expired. In the county east of Las Cruces, there was a cattle baron by the name of Cox. He had been operating a ranch in that county for a long time. With these preliminaries, I shall note what was said about Garrett's death at the time it happened and what I afterwards found out. I was Attorney General of New Mexico from 1907 to 1909. Garrett was killed in February of 1908 on the highway just east of Las Cruces. There was a man with him at the time by the name of Carl Adamson, whom I once defended on a charge of smuggling Chinamen into the United States. The report was brought to Las Cruces that a young man by the name of Wayne Brazell had killed Garrett in an altercation over a ranch. Apparently, the only disinterested witness was Adamson. New Mexico was a territory at that time, and the Attorney General was an appointee of the federal government. George Curry was the governor and a personal friend of mine. He came to me soon after the news of Garrett's murder was out and said that he would go down to Las Cruces the next day to the funeral and suggested that I go along, as the talk was running pretty high among Garrett's friends and there might be trouble. It had gotten out that Albert B. Fall, later U.S. Senator, had been retained to defend Brazell, and that the district attorney was a pretty close friend of Fall's. He thought there should be an independent investigation. I went to Las Cruces, and while the governor was attending the funeral, I saw Carl Adamson and asked him to go with me and show me the exact place where Garrett was killed and how it happened. We took Fred Fornoff from Santa Fe along with us. He was a noted peace officer and captain of the state mounted police. Adamson said he had met Garrett in El Paso and had indicated that he wanted to buy a ranch, and Garrett said that he had one east of Las Cruces that he would like to sell. He and Adamson had gone to the ranch, looked it over, and were returning to Las Cruces in a buckboard. Brazell caught up with them on horseback. Adamson saw that Brazell had a Winchester strapped to his saddle, but didn't see any other arms. Garrett had a sawed-off shotgun leaning against the dashboard in front of the buckboard. This he always carried in that place. Brazell said to Garrett, "I understand you're trying to sell the ranch." And Garrett said he was, that he was trying to sell it to the man he had there with him. Brazell said, "You leased me that ranch, and you can't sell it." Garrett replied either that he had not leased it to him or that it was subject to sale. They talked along rather heatedly for a while, and then Garrett reached for the shotgun and said, "If I can't get you off of it one way, I will another." Brazell, instead of reaching for his Winchester, pulled a six-shooter and shot Garrett twice. Adamson said that at the exact time that this occurred, he had asked Garrett to stop and let him get out for a minute. He further stated that he was several feet away at the rear of the buckboard and off to the side of the road at the actual time the killing occurred. The reaching for the shotgun and the remark that Garrett made was not stated by Adamson, but was stated by Brazell at his trial. While Fred Fornoff and Adamson were talking, we had stopped our buckboard at the same place where he said Garrett had stopped, I walked back some 30 or 40 feet to where Adamson said he had stood, and at that place I happened to spy a new Winchester rifle shell on the ground. Garrett was shot in the back of the head and once in the front of his body. The place where I was told that he was found was not in his buckboard, but on the side of the road. In this particular locality on the south side of the road, there are high sand hills, and on the north side, the black brush was pretty thick. A few days later, I heard Brazell's story about this, and the whole thing looked suspicious to me. Garrett being found not in the buckboard, but on the side of the road. The finding of the shell also was a strange development. Brazell had never been considered a dangerous man. A number of other things aroused my suspicions. We returned to Santa Fe that night, and the next day I told Captain Fornoff that there was something wrong about the story. He said he thought so too, but that we had no money to try and find out anything. A month or so later, I had business in El Paso, where Garrett had spent a good deal of time, and found out who some of his friends were. One was Tom Powers, who was the owner of the Coney Island Saloon and pretty well-to-do. Another was Dr. Cullinan. I took a personal interest in this matter because Garrett had been a friend of my father, and if he had been murdered, I thought the guilty party should be prosecuted. I told these two friends about my suspicions and told them that if we had the money to put a detective in that country for a few months undercover, that it would be revealed whether my suspicions were well-founded, but they did not seem to want to put up any money. I came to Lincoln in 1886, a small boy with my father, and to Roswell in 1887. I knew, by reputation at least, a man in White Oaks who afterward became prominent as a writer. He had moved to Chicago. His name was Emerson Hough. While he was in White Oaks, he wrote Heart's Desire, and afterwards The Covered Wagon, and a series of stories in the Saturday Evening Post called The Wasteful West. I knew that he was friendly with Garrett because Garrett had obtained for him the material for The Wasteful West stories. I went to Chicago some 6 or 8 months after Garrett's death and contacted Hough and told him this entire story and asked him if he, alone or with some of their friends, would make up $1,000 or so to try to find out who killed Garrett. But he said Garrett owed him considerable money and that he was pretty pushed for money anyway and he couldn't do it. Then he made this remark, "Jimmy, I know that outfit around the Oregon Mountains, and Garrett got killed for trying to find out who killed Fountain, and you will get killed trying to find out who killed Garrett. I would advise you to let it alone." After this admonition, I decided not to be so active, but I never lost interest in trying to find out whether my suspicions were well-founded. After my return from El Paso, I told Captain Fornoff that he had an expense account and that he might try to get up some kind of business in El Paso and see what he could find out. There were still a bunch of tough characters around El Paso, not the least of whom was Tom Powers himself. Another was Manning Clements, the brother-in-law of Carl Adamson, the sole witness in the killing. Fornoff made the trip to El Paso and came back and said he had made a real discovery, but he did not know whether he would ever be able to prove it. To understand this discovery, I must introduce Jim Miller. Jim Miller was a notorious cold-blooded assassin from Texas. It had been pretty well known that he had on several occasions murdered people for pay. He started his career by killing the sheriff of Reeves County, Texas. Fornoff had learned that a wealthy ranchman near El Paso had hired Miller to kill Garrett, whom the rancher despised, and had paid Miller $1,500 to do the job. The money had been handed over to Miller in the office of some lawyer in El Paso by Manning Clements. Part of the deal was that the ranchman would furnish a man who would say he killed Garrett in self-defense, and the rancher was also to furnish one witness who would corroborate the statement. The trouble was that Fornoff had no proof. Rizal was the man who was to say he killed Garrett in self-defense, with Adamson, Manning Clement's brother-in-law, as the witness. I was prosecuting attorney of the 5th Judicial District from 1903 to 1907. Roosevelt County had then just been created. There was a notorious character, Joe Beasley, who was always getting into small difficulties in court, gambling without a license, selling liquor to minors, and other small offenses. He was always turning up as a witness for defendants in criminal cases. Jim Miller had been in Portales the year before and had defrauded a man out of several thousand sheep. I knew that Beasley knew all about this deal and knew Miller, and that he might know something about Garrett's death. I sent a man that Beasley would trust to talk to him, and he revealed the entire story. Beasley said that Miller came through Portales early in the morning before this killing and said he wanted a horse, that he was going to make a long ride to Las Cruces and bump off Garrett, and that he must get to Fort Worth as soon as possible to have an alibi. Beasley further reported that Miller said that when he got to Fort Worth, he would send this Portales fellow a telegram so a record would be made and he could say that he was in Fort Worth at this time. Miller confirmed the story that the ranchman referred to employed him to do this and was to furnish the witness and the party who would claim that he killed Garrett in self-defense. This story must be true, because it corroborates not only what Fornoff found out in El Paso, but it also corroborates the general circumstances of the case as above related. The suspicion that Garrett was shot in the back of the head, the killing occurred at a place where a man could easily hide and do the shooting. The finding of the Winchester shell some 50 feet off the road, and the unlikelihood that Brazell would have killed Garrett, or that Garrett would have made such a fool play. In my own mind, I am satisfied that the above is the way Garrett met his death, and that it grew out of his constant desire to find out who killed Fountain. Nearly everybody connected with the case is now, in 1953, dead. Brazell, a big strapping fellow, died suddenly of a heart attack. The ranchman died recently. Adamson died of typhoid fever. Somebody killed Manning Clements in El Paso. And Miller was hanged in Oklahoma by a mob for murdering a former United States Marshal. True West Magazine, January 2022 edition. Best of the West 2022, Western Fair, by Sherry Monahan. Oysters and champagne ring in the new year. The tradition has been enjoyed across the West for more than 150 years. Champagne and oysters went hand in hand when pioneers issued in the new year on the frontier. The Perkins County Herald Sentinel in Grant, Nebraska, was one of many newspapers that advertised dances and oyster suppers available in their cities. Oysters were the trendy food in America during the 19th century. They were largely imported from the East Coast, but some came from Mexico and the West Coast. Merchants advertised headquarters for oysters, bulk oysters, 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 oyster, the best, the freshest, and the cheapest. Oysters were used by the ladies in Helena, Montana, who held a holiday fair in 1875 to raise funds for the Catholic Church. The event was held at the International Hall on Broadway, where a variety of items were offered. They advertised, "Refreshments, including oysters in every style, will be served at all hours. A grand dinner will be served on Christmas and New Year's." Champagne, of course, can only come from France, but California was well on its way to creating some tasty sparkling wines. However, 19th century California winemakers, mostly from Europe, referred to all sparkling wines as champagnes. Schramsberg, Cook's, and Korbel were and still are made in California and were wildly popular and well known. French brands included Du de Montebello, Perrier Jouet, Louis Roederer, and de Montigny, and they averaged about $30 per bottle in 1887. Compare that to a minor salary, which was about $4 a day. Kansas City, Missouri celebrated the arrival of 1891 in high style with parties, theater events, and a wicked snowstorm. One local paper reported, "The snow commenced, a blustering wind arose, and the thermometer dropped a few notches below freezing." Despite the weather, the manager of the Western Sash and Door Company threw a banquet for associates and employees. The menu included oysters and cream, ham with champagne sauce, lobster salad, Saratoga chips, champagne punch, Roman punch, angel food cake, lady fingers, bananas, oranges, and nuts. San Francisco was a bustling city by 1892, and its residents celebrated New Year's Day in style. Dining out at the luxurious Palace Hotel was a special treat that not everyone could afford, but those who could were pampered. The extensive menu included over 100 wines, liquors, liqueurs, and more. Champagne offerings included Perrier Jouet, Moyet and Chandon, Monopole, Jules Mumm, Veuve Clicquot, and El Roederer. Dinner began with clams and oysters, followed by green turtle consommé and puree of goose soup. Hors d'oeuvres included radishes, olives, and celery. The fish course included trout and filet of sole, served with Duchess potatoes. Following that was a course of Virginia ham braised with champagne sauce. For the main entrees, diners could choose from spring chicken, filet mignon, lamb steak, and mallard duck. Assorted vegetables included asparagus on toast, artichokes with hollandaise sauce, mashed potatoes, squash, boiled rice, French peas, French string beans, and baked sweet potatoes. Roman punch was served next to cleanse the palate before the next course of cold meats, which included beef, chicken, turkey, goose, lamb, veal, and mutton. As if that wasn't enough already, patrons needed to loosen their waistbands because the roast course was next. It included prime ribs of beef, teal duck, mallard duck, lamb, goose, stuffed turkey, fresh pork, veal, and domestic duck. The salad course followed this and included lobster, duchet, and romaine. If anyone had room for dessert, they could choose from English plum pudding with rum or hard sauce, apricot and pear tartlets, mince, apple, and pumpkin pies, and coconut cream sandwiches. The meal ended with ices that included orange water, strawberry, and pistachio ice cream. The Omaha Daily Bee in Nebraska suggested some champagne-themed items to serve for the new year, including champagne punch and a cheese spread, recipe below. The punch included a half cup of lemon juice, a pound of sugar, 2 quarts of water, a quart of sherry, 2 quarts of Moselle white wine, a glass each of maraschino, curacao, chartreuse, 2 glasses of Benedictine, a pint of brandy, and 4 quarts of champagne. Best Historic Saloon of the West, Miners and Stockmen Steakhouse and Spirits, Hartville, Wyoming. Open year-round, Tuesday through Sunday, 5 to 10 p.m., Miners and Stockmen Steakhouse and Spirits has the oldest bar in Wyoming and is famous for its steak and whiskey selection. Its Brunswick bar was made in Germany in 1862 and was originally used at the Fort Laramie Officers Club. Miners first settled the area in the 1870s, and the town was founded in 1884. Wyoming'sOldestBar.com. Reader's Choice, Big Nose Kate's, Tombstone, Arizona. Best Historic Restaurant, The Palace Restaurant and Saloon, Prescott, Arizona. The Palace's swinging doors have been open on Montezuma Street, better known as Whiskey Row, and Prescott since at least 1877. Famously rebuilt in 1901 around its 1880s Brunswick Bar, which was carried across to the Courthouse Plaza during the Prescott Fire of 1900, the Palace is Arizona's oldest operating saloon. In 1996, the Palace permanently added a restaurant, which is well known for its cowboy cuisine, Old West dining atmosphere, and 19th century frontier reenactors. WhiskeyRowPalace.com. Reader's Choice, Buckhorn Exchange, Denver, Colorado. Best Chuck Wagon Cook-Off, Lincoln County Cowboy Symposium, Ruidoso Downs, New Mexico. Founded by legendary New Mexico cowboy singer Ray Reed in 1990, the Lincoln County Cowboy Symposium has grown from its humble roots in Glencoe, New Mexico, to one of the biggest annual festivals celebrating the cowboy way of life. Held at the Ruidoso Downs Racetrack and Casino every October, the 3 days offer visitors world-class cowboy music, a championship chuck wagon cook-off, events for the whole family, and a Western Expo with over 110 vendors. CowboySymposium.com. Reader's Choice, Wild West Fest, Andrews, Texas. Best Chuck Wagon Show and Supper, Fort Hays Chuck Wagon Supper and Show, Rapid City, South Dakota. Held at the Fort Hays Old West Town Square, This event is fun for the whole family and produced in the style of the famous Branson, Missouri variety music shows. The ever-popular Old West Dinner Theater is open annually mid-May until the end of September. MountRushmoreTours.com. Reader's Choice, Chuck Wagon Festival, National Cowboy Museum, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And now the recipe. Champagne blue cheese spread. 1 tablespoon butter, softened. 1 cup blue cheese, or to taste. Dash cayenne pepper, or to taste. Dry champagne, enough to moisten. Place the butter, cheese, and pepper into a bowl and blend with a fork. Stir in enough champagne to moisten the mixture so it will spread onto crackers. Serve with champagne. Recipe adapted from the Omaha Daily Bee, December 30th, 1898.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.